As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for an HPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, Managing Director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of NHPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that NHPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Is poetry having a moment? It could be after the dazzling performance of poet Amanda Gorman at Joe Biden's inauguration last week. And so, Exchange listeners, we're talking about the power of poetry and how this ancient art form has been ever-evolving, speaking to Americans now in the 21st century. Let's hear from you. Tell us what poem is inspiring you these days and what role poetry plays in your life. Also, if you're someone who doesn't think you like poetry, why is that? What's the turnoff? Email us. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. So we had three poets with us today. They are Allison Adair, associate professor at Boston College, where she teaches creative writing with a focus on poetry, flash fiction, and the digital humanities. Her first award-winning book of poems is called The Clearing. Also with us, Joshua Bennett, assistant professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College. His books include Being Property Once Myself, Blackness and the End of Man, along with the award-winning The Sobbing School. And Alexandria Peary is here, New Hampshire poet laureate and the author of seven books, most recently The Water Draft and COVID Spring, Granite State Pandemic Poems. She's an English professor at Salem State University. Well, a big welcome to everybody. It's been about a week since the inauguration. And Joshua, you first, please. Why are some people still talking about this poem by Amanda Gorman?
Well, I think because the poem's phenomenal. It's beautifully delivered, beautifully written. And I think it calls upon a number of different traditions all at once, right? If we look at the performance on the screen as opposed to on the page, we see in the cadence and the hand gestures, a spoken word tradition that's incredibly rich and includes people like Saul Williams and Sonny Patterson and Patricia Smith that, like Gorman, really blur the distance between the page and poems given to the air. So I think it was a striking difference for an inaugural poem, and it was the kind of beauty that a lot of us don't have the chance to encounter in our everyday lives.
Yeah, it wasn't just a poem, Joshua. It was performance. I'm glad you mentioned that. Talk a little bit more about just the difference between reading that poem on the page and going, okay, that's good, and seeing it performed.
Sure. So even if we look at one of the earlier lines in the poem, we lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms. And then we see so beautifully, right? Amanda lifts her arms and lays them down. There's a way that she was working to embody the poem that I think is critically important, because it's different than if you're reading it, right? She dares to say, actually, my live self here is part of what I want you to understand about the words on this piece of paper. And I think that's a different part of one's brain that goes into composing a poem and goes into sharing it with millions of people.
Well, since we're going to talk about this for a couple minutes, let's just hear a little of Amanda Gorman's inaugural poem. We'll play the last 30 seconds or so of the poem. Again, it was called The Hill We Climb.
We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover in every known nook of our nation, in every corner called our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
Again, that's Amanda Gorman reading her inaugural poem, The Hill We Climb, last week at Joe Biden's inauguration. Allison, what do you think? Why are people still talking about this? Still lots of chatter over what Amanda Gorman did.
I would agree, of course, with everything that Joshua said. Also, I think that rhyme has an effect on us. It has an effect on our bodies. There's a pleasure to the resolution of a rhyming pair or a triple rhyme, as is often used in Amanda Gorman's poems. But there's also a commentary in all of her poems that I think maybe our heads wrestle with or our hearts wrestle with, even as our pulses appreciate the rhyme, just the pleasure of the rhyme. So in that last example, you know, there's light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it, that the idea of moving from just witnessing something or spectating something to actually inhabiting it or letting it inhabit you, that's really important. And that's something that comes up throughout the rhymes of her poem. Another one I love is earlier on where she says, and yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We're striving to forge a union with purpose. And I love how she shifts there from perfect, the idea of perfection, to purpose, which is work. And you can see people with their arm, you know, with their sleeves sort of pushed up. She has so many rhymes like that where, you know, she transitions from, we get the pleasure of the rhyme, but she transitions in meaning to something that rouses people. So I thought that was smart and interesting and stirred people.
What do you think, Alexandria? What might this sort of knockout performance really do for poetry overall?
Oh, wow. Well, I think, you know, I want to say first, you mind me speaking about this poem as a public performance for
sure.
a second? And I think that contributes to what you're asking, because poetry shouldn't be something that's just kept in a book or, you know, a tiny bookstore reading someplace. It has this really big potential. And I think it's shown in her poem so well. This poem is an exemplary piece of public performance. I mean, what I noticed about it was she's writing, if I got this right, she was writing during all the turmoil of up until in the starting the month of January politically in our country, right? And the way in which she handles details in this poem, speaking to the time that we're experiencing, the way in which she has the pronouns we, you know, she starts off with a question. Her poem is the first two lines are a question, and she uses we throughout. And the details and the rhyming. And then there's a reference to herself. I take it to be a reference to herself about three quarters of the way down, a descendant of a slave raised by a single mother. And there's only one personal pronoun in the whole piece. There's a my somewhere down below. And she just, the way in which she talks about the collective experiencing right now politically in the country, through those details, through the musicality, all that is just marvelous.
I want to ask all of you about the sort of political dimension of Gorman's poem and other poetry. I mean, poets have always commented on what's going on in society. But one more question for you, Joshua. When we played that clip, I was thinking it kind of sounds like a sermon or a prayer.
Oh, for sure. I mean, part of what I love, too, about Amanda's performance is the way that it calls upon all these other public forms of passionate utterance, right? Mm-hmm. So one hears potentially the influence of the Black church. One hears the sounds, at least in my own memory, thinking about 125th Street, the bustles of sort of not just street corner preachers, but people selling their wares, gemstones, fur coats, this ongoing commitment to beauty that's tied to how we talk in public. And I love what Alexandria said about the idea that poetry is not something that's meant to be kept inside. Lest we forget, Amanda comes out of a National Youth Poet Laureate program that actually started in New York City at Urban Word NYC, which is a nonprofit organization that's committed to spoken word and public performance for young people. So Amanda's coming out of a proud, long tradition, and it was great to see it on center stage.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit later about other connections between poetry, which I know some people think of as sort of old and dusty, and the very modern applications that we see. But to the point that I think you all made, and that is that there is a sort of political element to this poem. And Allison, to you first, please, what are some other examples of poetry that have spoken broadly to the nation and where it was at that particular moment? You can take past examples or present examples, Allison.
Oh, there are so many. I would probably, if you weren't here, be inclined to mention a lot of the poems of Joshua Bennett.
Go ahead.
I think one of the refrains in poetry is that the personal is political, and any decision to write anything down is a political act, whether you decide to focus explicitly on politics or not. An example of something that hits people politically, even in retrospect, that's unlikely, is Robert Frost's Mending Wall, of all things, which people might remember from the famous phrase that came up in it, good fences make good neighbors. And I love that poem partly because I think in retrospect, at least, a lot of people read that as a commentary on a sort of isolationist relationship between the United States and other countries, this game of chicken where two people are staying apart from each other and not disclosing the closeness that they long for as neighbors, and how there's a kind of self-protective nature to that. And just politically how that resonates, it's a very small, simple story, you know, about two neighbors, but it has this really broad resonance for like geopolitics.
Wow.
So that would be one example. Of course, the contemporary examples.
Wow, that's a cultural statement, isn't it? Mending Wall by Robert Frost. And, you know, listeners, if you've got a book of Frost or Cummings or one of our guests' books, you know, pull it out and tell us what poems speak to you, especially at this moment that we're in as a country. It's been a really difficult year. Let's just say that. So let's also just hear from listeners. What pieces of poetry, what lines are speaking to you, especially right now? We'd love for you to join us. It's 800-892-6477. 800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also use Facebook. Alex, how about you? Poetry and politics.
I'm really, really crazy about Pablo Neruda's odes to objects. I frequently teach them. This is an older poet from the 20th century because he's celebrating the objects in our lives, the food, the materials that we maybe didn't have. We didn't actually take part in making or building, but we rely on and celebrating the worker. But more recently, if I may just make a pitch for the two websites, the Academy of American Poets and Poetry Foundation, right? They have wonderful political poems constantly up there for people to check out. And I'm also really crazy about Claudia Rankine's book, Citizen, which is a book that I've taught in the past in my courses. I think this is a great time to be interested in politics as a poet, a timely, necessary time to be doing that.
So give us those two resources again, Alex, where sure. People can find more links. And we'll put them on our website as well, nhpr.org/exchange. But go ahead, Alex. Sure.
Okay, so the Academy of American Poets and then the Poetry Foundation. You can go there, and they're so generous. They have tons and tons of poems. They're organizing them around categories, and they've made a real commitment to political poetry and speaking about things that are happening now. So I would check it out.
Joshua, who are some of your favorite poets, past or present, that kind of use their poetry to sum up where the nation was at?
June Jordan, as the first person that comes to mind, was someone who not just wrote so beautifully about the America she knew, but the future possibilities of an America that must eventually realize itself, right? She was a powerful anti-imperialist voice. Langston Hughes, I think, is someone else who's written so powerfully about this future vision that we all have to commit to, which is also tied, of course, I think, to the inaugural poem we're all here to discuss. Lucille Clifton, Audre Lorde, Claude McKay, who I'll hopefully read a little bit about later. These were all people who had a utopian vision of not just where we are, but what we can become and where we can go. And I think that's the most powerful thing that poetry can do. It can give us the materials for another world, even as we engage in protracted struggle in the present.
Well, here's a poem that Meg in Dover sent in. She says, two of my favorite poems are Jane Kenyon's Let Evening Come and Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. And then Meg says, there's a poem my brother wrote for his first grade teacher 50 years ago, The Rabbit Who Lived on the Hill. And I'm going to read it because it's short and it's great. The rabbit who lived on the hill, he swallowed my vitamin pill. He got up at dawn and mowed the whole lawn, the rabbit who lived on the hill. But I'd rather be swimming with Miss Stimming. So I hope if Meg's brother's listening, I interpreted it okay. But, you know, Joshua, the poem that Meg sent reminds us that poetry doesn't have to all be sort of cultural commentary or deep pain. It can be fun.
It should be fun, I think, as a matter of fact, you know. I spoke a little bit just a second ago about June Jordan, but her first workshops were actually committed to children, right? In 1974, she creates a workshop in Brooklyn called The Voice of the Children that's all about actually committing to children's poetry and creating anthologies out of it, right? The idea is that poetry is actually explicitly for this next generation and not just a political imagination they'll develop, but also the robust imagination they already have, writing about animals and plants and the toys they love, writing about their families and their favorite spots in the park, Any poetry worth its salt, I think, also has to have that joy and delight bound up in it.
Meg, it's great that you wrote. And let's take a call. This is Joe in Silver Lake. Hi, Joe. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So being a Silver Lake, New Hampshire resident, E.E. Cummings is a profound influence because, as most you may know, he spent every summer of his life in Silver Lake. When I think of his poems, really anything by E.E. Cummings is inspirational to me. But at this point in time in history, I am reminded of his poem, I Sing of Olaf. And in particular, the line in that poem where he says, I will not kiss your effing flag. And certainly, even today, maybe a shocking line, but it resonates with us. But given the time period when it was written and after both the Great Wars, I think it's a profound line, and it's still applicable today.
Wow, Joe, I'm so glad you called, and thank you for not swearing on the air, because we don't do that, so I really appreciate that. I'm really glad he called. Two things. Alex, first of all, I did not know that E.E. Cummings spent his summers in New Hampshire, but I am well aware, Alex, of our state's long tradition with poetry. I've often said there must be something in the granite or the water here. How would you describe New Hampshire's connection in particular with poetry?
Oh, it's long and deep for sure. In fact, actually, the Poetry Society of New Hampshire just put out a fabulous, I really recommend people checking this out, magazine, the issue devoted to poet laureates in New Hampshire, starting with the very first person. And they did a great job compiling not just the people's poems, but also some bio background on their work and who they were in New Hampshire. And it's really interesting because the poet laureates of New Hampshire embody a range of careers and interests in serving the state, and they've, you know, gone on to do some really interesting things, so for sure.
You know, Allison, when people think of E.E. Cummings, they think of him as someone who sort of broke barriers, but poetry's evolving all the time, as you know better than me, Allison. How would you describe what E.E. Cummings and other poets did to kind of always push the art form into its next phase?
Well, tying in Joe's comment, in fact, that is a very brutal poem, I Sing of Olaf, Glad and Big. One of the things that Cummings was doing, I think, with that poem, which is a long narrative poem, a longer narrative poem compared to a lot of his shorter sonnet-like poems, is to recast the idea of political opposition as something that's urban and as something, he wanted to recast it as someone, as coming from an upper Midwest, a Scandinavian guy named Olaf, who by all counts in the premise of his poem would be considered quote unquote patriotic. So just in terms of the theme of that poem and some of E.E. Cummings' other poems, I think he wanted to shake up basic value systems and sort of lazy or casual attributions of, you know, political allegiances to like one group versus another. But then, you know, just style-wise, he was such a maniac. Threw out punctuation, or he used it very expressively and unapologetically. He let sentences blur into each other. There's all sorts of interesting ways in which he creates, you know, speed bumps and asks us to read quickly and then slow down. And his line breaks and punctuation or lack thereof often dictate how we're supposed to experience a poem in terms of our breath. So he was doing a lot of original stuff.
That's really interesting. And I have to ask all of you this, because something you said, Allison, made me think of something else. How does poetry work? I'll start with you, Allison, but I want to hear from everybody. How does poetry work to help students understand the English language, appreciate the English language? Because we have a beautiful, flexible language. We have so many words that describe so many things. How does poetry help students understand English, appreciate English, while at the same time, as you said, Allison, it's busting up all the rules of English?
This is one of my favorite things to talk about. So one of the things I love, a lot of the classes I've taught over the years are requirements. So a lot of times I'll get students who hate poetry, think they hate poetry. One of my favorite things to do with them is to take poems and remove the line breaks, to change them into, and I've used one of Joshua's poems, he knows this, a version of a poem he has called Trash, where you, I remove all the line breaks. I do this, it's also great with William Stafford's Traveling Through the Dark, and make it a paragraph. And then I ask students to add their own line breaks. And what happens is they start saying, oh, there's all sorts of words that can go in different directions depending on how I position them or what I position them next to. And so they'll start to see the flexibility and elasticity of a given word like hand or rock or all sorts of things that can be verbs and nouns, et cetera. I find just a simple exercise like that can really remind people of how much depth there is to a single word.
Really interesting. I want to hear from everybody on this. Joshua, what do you think? Sort of using poetry as a way to enhance appreciation for our language while at the same time busting it up.
Sure. Well, first I want to thank Allison for lending me any space in her classroom. It's the highest grade. But yeah, I mean, I think it absolutely teaches students about what it means to be adventurous, right? In language. I went to a all Black private school when I was a little boy where we sang the Black national anthem every day, lift every voice and sing, and that's a poem. And part of what that did for me as a four-year-old was it taught me something about my place in history. It taught me that I was part of a continuum of consciousness and that that had everything to do with poetry and song, and that language wasn't dry or boring. Language was an event, right? Language is something that we gathered to make together. And I think poetry, when we bring it into the classroom, it reminds our students of that, to take chances and to believe in the electricity of the language that moves them the most.
Alex, can you weigh in on this?
Yeah, and I want to first say, boy, lucky students who have Joshua and Allison. You have lucky students to be in your classes. So for me, I think poetry is terrific because it has such a texture, language with so much texture. And what I'm really interested in as a teacher is getting students to drop their preconceptions about their own relationship to writing, whether it's poetry or other genre, and that all of us have that ability to rearrange creatively and follow our own language on the page if we just let go of the fact that we think maybe a student might think they're not very good at poetry or not very creative or et cetera, et cetera. Poetry lets us drop some preconceptions about ourselves as well as writers, I think.
It's kind of funny, isn't it, Alex? If you're an English teacher or professor, you're kind of doing two things. In one class, you may be saying, you know, here's how nouns and verbs and punctuation and, you know, clauses work. And in your poetry class, you're saying, forget all that.
Or handling the first poetically, you know. You can do some pretty cool things in a composition class with the same sort of approach. Languages, poems, I think the word for poem originally came etymologically to make, makers, right? So it's like making an object, only you're doing it with language and punctuation. And that stuff can be brought into a composition class or a rhetorical class too, I think.
Well, we have to take a very short break, but when we come back, we're going to have our guests read some poetry that inspires them, poets who they've turned to for inspiration. And as we head into that break, I do want to read something we got from Megan Landaff, who says, I have found so much newfound comfort in poetry during this pandemic and time for quiet reflection. One of my beloved lines is from Mary Oliver. The poem is Why I Wake Early. And the two lines Meg shared with us, watch now how I start the day in happiness, in kindness. Meg, thank you for writing in. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and share your poems with us, your favorites, maybe something you've been writing. That's all coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's not quite a poetry slam on the air, but we are talking about the enduring power of poetry today. And we'd love to hear from you. What poetry is calling to you right now over this difficult year? Where do you see and hear poetry all around you, even if it isn't officially a poem? Email us. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-9898. 6477. Our three poets that are with us today have all published works and have won awards that we encourage you to check out on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, along with the poetry resources that they've been mentioning. Again, nhpr.org/exchange. We're talking with Allison Adair from Boston College, Joshua Bennett with Dartmouth College, and Alexandria Peary with Salem State University. She's also New Hampshire's poet laureate. And all of you, so we'd like you all to share a poem or a few lines from a poem that influenced you as poets. And Joshua, you first, please.
Sure. So the poem I've selected is probably no surprise to anyone who knows me. It's a poem that when I was just a baby poet starting out, taught me everything about economy and what it might mean to write courageously. This is "Won't You Celebrate With Me" by Lucille Clifton. Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up. Here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
So that's Lucille Clifton's "Won't You Celebrate With Me." And Joshua, when you were a baby poet, and I love that imagery, what is it that drew you in about that, Joshua?
The breadth of it. It's a poem that tries to take in the whole of human history, right? Sitting on the bridge between starshine and clay. And it's such a short poem, right? It packs so much power. And I love the idea that we end on this note of persistence, right? Which in so much of my writing, not just in poetry and literary criticism, I think is one of the primary aims and tropes of African-American literature, the idea that we can survive, and not just that, we can survive what we were never meant to survive, and we can do it together. So
it's encouraging.
It's hopeful, and more than that, it's brave.
So Allison, go ahead, a poem that inspires you.
This is my baby poet moment. Set it up, if you don't mind. I was 19 on the west coast of Ireland. It was the first time I had been out of the country, and I thought I was studying painting in this barn on the west coast of Ireland. And C.D. Wright showed up to teach a little bit about poetry to my group. And so I was in a barn and she stood up and I thought, oh, you know, poetry, I don't know. And she read this poem and I felt changed. So this is from her book, String Light. It's called "More Blues and the Abstract Truth." I back the car over a soft, large object. Hair appears on my chest in dreams. The paper boy comes to collect with a pit bull. Call grandmother, and she says, well, you know, death is death and none other. In the mornings, we're in the dark. Even at the end of June, the zucchini keep on the sill. Ring grandmother for advice, and she says, oh, you know, I used to grow so many things. Hmm. There's the frequent bleeding, the tender nipples, and the rot under the floor mat. If I'm not seeing a cold-eyed doctor, it is another gouging mechanic. Grandmother says, thanks to the blue rugs and Eileen Briscoe's elms, the house keeps cool. Well, then you say, grandmother, let me just ask you this. How does a body rise up again and rinse her mouth from the tap? And how does a body put in a plum tree or lie again on top of another body or string a trellis or go on drying the flatware, fix rainbow trout, grout the tile, buy a bag of onions, beat an egg stiff? Yes, how does the cat continue to lick itself from toenail to tail hole? And how does a body break bread with the word when the word has broken again and again with the wine and the loaf and the excellent glass of the body? And she says, even if the sky is falling, my peace rose is in bloom.
Wow, that's amazing, Allison. In Ireland, a country that definitely celebrates its poets and writers, probably more than many other countries. That's great. So can you just tell us a little bit about what drew your baby poet self to that poem, Allison?
I think it was the unknowing, you know, the fact that I, as a student, a friend student actually in grad school said about Emily Dickinson, she gestured to her forehead and said, I don't understand her here. And then she put her fist to her gut and said, but I understand her here. And I think that's what it was. I I felt like there was this expressive rhythm and this nod to heritage and dialogue and this self-assurance partway through the poem that then is undone by the grandmother's, you know, sort of stiff reply at the end. I just thought that there were so many dimensions in the subtext. It's not, there's an arc, but it's not a short story. So to me, I think at that point, I had thought of all poems as just really, really condensed short stories. Yeah. And this was the first one I heard that I thought, oh, this is something completely new.
So Alex, go ahead. What's the poem that always grabs you, even to this day?
Okay, my poet is Yanis Ritsos, the Greek poet who spent quite a bit of time incarcerated for his own political activity. And it's a two stanza poem, but I'm only going to read the first stanza, and if people are curious about it, might want to go pursue it. It's a poem called, What's the Use? What's the use? Everything ages, wears out, becomes useless, he said. Clandestine smoke, closed rooms, flags, men killed, proclamations, statues. The white curtain has turned yellow, the mirrors scratched along with the face. Moths have settled on the lovely dress you wore that night. The corner coffee house has closed down. The balcony has fallen face first in the nettles, the statues in the garden without a phallus. So what's the use of sorrow? What's the use of hatred, of freedom, the absence of freedom, the silver coffee spoons, the bank account, the gold dentures of the dead woman, the sun, the two candlesticks on the table, the aspirins? What's the use of love and of poetry?
Thank you, Alex. And I don't want to fall into the trap, Alex, of what does that poem mean? Because I was reading yesterday, that's a good way to ruin a poem. What does that poem mean? What is the poet trying to say? But just can you tell us why you love that one so much?
Okay, the reason why I love it is I'm also concealing the second stanza from our audience here. So check out the poem, What's the Use? I love teaching this poem too, because it's enigmatic, mysterious, but also very concrete. And it's so gut related. It gets me right to my heart. And he asks this question, this despairing question in the title, a voice-driven title, what's the use? You know, that's something we might say to our friend or text somebody, right? And then he has this long series of details. And he ends that stanza with a question, what's the use of love and of poetry? But the next stanza presumably has an answer, and it's a very strange and mysterious answer. And I just feel affirmed by this poem. I just feel affirmed by the entire thing through the way in which he brings up big things and also mundane everyday things and abstractions and concrete things in the same poem with these powerful questions. I love it.
Yeah. Well, so everybody Google Yanis Ritsos, What's the Use, to find out what that second stanza says. And you can also join us with a phone call, 800-892-6477. Tell us what poetry is speaking to you right now during this very difficult year that we've all been living in. Again, our number is 800-892-6477. People have been also writing in their favorite poems. It's exchange@nhpr.org. You can also put your own poetry, if you'd like, on our Facebook page. For now, put it on our Facebook page if you're writing some of your own poetry. And we'll publish as much as we can on our website later. That's nhpr.org/exchange. So, Allison, the poems that you all read, you know, they're rich, they're deep. How do poets adapt their art form to this era that we're in right now? Instant communication, constant communication, people scrolling on their phones very, very quickly. I'm turning to you first, Allison, because you teach a course on digital humanities. So go ahead.
Well, you know, it's funny, I've been thinking about this lately. The first thing I'd say is that I think poetry in a way can be a refuge from some of the rapidity of current communication. Ada Limon talks about how poetry requires a breath, even if someone isn't reading aloud, the end of a line and the beginning of a line, they require us to stop, even involuntarily. And I love that idea that poems create that space for a little bit of more concentrated breathing. That said, there are a bunch of poets. Dinesh Smith, I think, is amazing in terms of having a lot of contemporary references and playing around with visual form in a way that suggests like the crowded nature of current communication, but also then carves it away and looks for something essential in human exchange. There's a poet named Dana Patterson Kidd. or Dana Kidd Patterson, I think it is. She has a poem called Dear Robe of Stars. I don't know if the poem itself is available online, though her collection, If Mother Braids a Waterfall, is beautiful. But Dear Robe of Stars, she's recreated as a YouTube video, a sewing exercise with her and her daughters, and it's transcendent. So it's using modern technology, but in order to create a kind of enduring ancient space that poetry really is known for.
Yeah, I wonder about that, Joshua. I'd love your thoughts, too. Again, poetry seems to me, and I'm not an expert, needs to be something you sit with and that you take some time to contemplate. And that is definitely not what we tend to do on social media.
Sure. But I think at the same time, what's really interesting is the way that not just social media, but even platforms like YouTube have also opened the floodgates for all sorts of new and interesting poetry to come to the fore. I think about a platform like a Button Poetry, for instance, on YouTube, which has over 1 million subscribers, right? Which might have seemed unimaginable in another age. But I am really interested in how, especially as someone who's, you know, has his performances from high school still living on YouTube, you know, now the 17-year-old boy with big t-shirts. I think a lot about the fact that for some of us, the internet became the first space for us to really share our ideas, especially in communities that maybe, you know, didn't have any easy pipeline to the publishing world. So it's a double-edged sword.
Oh, that's interesting. So given how difficult it is for baby poets to be published, Joshua, the internet is a great place because you can put it out there and see who likes it.
Sure. I mean, my career really started because someone captured an open mic performance on a camera phone. And then that video went viral. And that became a way for me to travel and share my work at colleges and universities and, you know, now share nature poems with sixth graders. You know, so there's all kind of beautiful opportunities, I think, that the internet opens up as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that, actually, Joshua. You gave us a little bit there. But how did that happen that the internet helped you become, you know, a poet at Dartmouth College?
Oh, sure. That's a great question. Well, I mean, I started out in poetry slam and spoken word. I didn't really grow up reading books of poetry. For me, poetry was something that I saw recited aloud. I heard poetry in the sermons of Baptist and Pentecostal ministers of my youth. And it wasn't really until, again, this camera phone video went viral and I got an agent and I started traveling and performing for these auditoriums full of college students that I really started to get my feet as a poet and started to study books on my own. I have a PhD in English, but I'm a self-taught poet. You know, as I just studied by reading it and watching the videos of people I loved. And that's how my career started and really how I became a professor, you know, was by falling in love with this work as an audience member.
Allison, what effects do you see social media having on poetry as an art form? For good or for ill? Actually, Alex, I want to ask you that first. Go ahead, Alex.
Well, I guess maybe because I approach things with a more, I guess, a Buddhist or more mindfulness perspective, I tend not to overly value anything. I don't value poetic language over other types of language. I think it's all language, you know? So, and I think about the internet, it just makes me think about, say, even Emily Dickinson, believe it or not, Emily Dickinson and the internet in the same sentence. She used to put her poems attached to gifts to neighbors or friends, jars of jam, you know, a baked good she made, and she'd lower it from her window or have somebody bring it to friends and put the language in with the object, right? And I just feel like, and I have my students do that too. They post their work in unusual places sometimes for certain classes. I just think it's great to not overly value one type of language over another, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense. And tell me a little bit more about that. So just like Emily Dickinson, you know, attaching some of her poetry to a plate of cookies, and how great would it be to be the recipient of that? Where are you having your students, Alex, post their poetry in, as you said, unusual places?
Okay, so in an Emily Dickinson class at Salem State, it was 2 years ago, students were doing a project in which they would be working on their own poems, but they would put them on campus, not in a graffiti type of way, but in unusual, unexpected places. You know, you'd slip papers in bathrooms, or they would make objects for people and I got myself a bunch of jam given to me by a student with all kinds of poems wrapped around the outside and labels and a potted plant that was partially got poetry in it, that kind of thing. just trying to not think of language having to be confined to the page or even the screen. You know, I mean, it can be I like to think of language wandering off and being the same as other types of things in the world. If that makes any sense.
It does make sense. And you learn something new every day. I did not know that Emily Dickinson did that. So as we head into a break, Tara, who is the dean of the UNH Library, says, please let listeners know that the UNH Library has special collections of New Hampshire poets, papers, letters, drafts, etc. Poet laureate Donald Hall gave his last public reading there a few years ago. There's also a collection on the history of teaching writing. So that's from Tara Fulton, the dean of the UNH Library. Tara, thank you for writing in. We will take a very quick break. When we come back, more listeners sharing poems that they love, and maybe you can share some of your own poetry if you're writing. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, how poetry endures, evolves, and the many forms it takes today. Listeners, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We have three poets with us, and you can learn more about their books and their work on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We also have more resources there about poetry. Our guests are Allison Adair from Boston College, Joshua Bennett with Dartmouth College, and Alexandria Peary with Salem State University. She's also the New Hampshire Poet Laureate. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners who are jumping in on this conversation. Steve is joining us from Bedford. Go ahead, Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. As usual, Laura, I enjoy your program very much.
Good.
So I dashed off a little poem because of what's going on lately. It isn't for the hungry to cry out when their need becomes too much to bear. It's for the better off as we travel about to feel the cries and rush to share. That's it.
Wow. And Steve, I'm sorry. Did you say that was something you wrote or something you came across lately?
Something I just wrote.
Okay. Well, bravo. I really appreciate you,
well, thank you
joining us. And I want to encourage listeners again, you know, if you're writing your own poetry like Steve, and Steve, thank you again, put it on our Facebook page, and then we will publish as much as we can on our website a little bit later, sort of have a crowdsourcing there of listener poetry. It's nhpr.org/exchange. It's great to hear from you, Steve. Let's go to Linda in South Berwick, Maine. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi. I in general, would like to speak to the issue of the power of poetry in the world and in my life personally, if I may.
Sure.
Former teacher from Oyster River Middle School Kids Language Arts. During the incredibly difficult time of 9/11, I turned to poetry as a way of them expressing themselves and dealing with the trauma in their lives. We ended up publishing a little book called Out of the Blue with their own art illustrations and poetry. And I still have my copy these years later. Many of my friends do. It's a treasure. Secondly, a very personal story. We lost our daughter when she was 17 in an automobile accident. Man made an illegal U-turn. And we decided the best way to cope with our loss, one of those abysses you fall into and can't climb out of, was to publish her poetry. She was a very dedicated poet. We did that within a year of losing her. And it was called A Box of Rain. And it was beautiful, and I shared it at some of the workshops that I did for English teachers. I met Don Murray there, and he said to me, "Are you writing about this yourself?" And I said, "Well, no." And he encouraged me to and invited me into a poetry group that he was part of.
Wow.
Let me see, we lost Abby many years ago. I'm 74 years old. I'm no spring chicken. But I, after all these years at the age of 70, decided to take his advice. I did write, but I just kept it to myself. I published my own book called Cobwebs and Glitter about my childhood, my poems about what it was like to pick blackberries and put them in a pie and play spin the bottle. And I just feel extraordinarily lucky to have discovered through our daughter, Abby, and also in my own teaching, because these moments of incredible shiny moments when kids share their writing, and you turn their writing around and say, "Read that out loud to me." You're just making me stop breathing. I find that poetry has turned out to be pretty much the heart of my life. My husband actually snagged me by writing me a poem. and putting it in my mailbox on parchment paper.
Wow. That's how he sort of courted you initially.
I couldn't believe it. He also sang me a Bob Dylan song and played the guitar for me. But that was, we've been married 53 years now, and I still, I have to chuckle when I think of the fact that when I opened the mailbox and found, I said, "Ooh, this is a man I don't want to let go of."
Well, it's great to hear from you, Linda. And, you know, even though it's been many, many years, my heart just hurts hearing about your daughter. That's just devastating. And it's wonderful that you shared with us how poetry kind of helped you maybe not completely heal from that, but process it. So thank you so much for calling in. And all three of you, Joshua, Allison, Alex, as promised, we want to give the stage to you to read some of your own poetry. So, Alex, you first give us the name of the poem, please, and share it with us.
Sure. So my poem comes from my last book, and it's in couplets, so two-line stanzas, and it's called Self-Portrait with Figure in Ski Mask. Self-portrait with figure in ski mask, or green V-neck sweater, or long-sleeved nightgown sprinkled with 100 types of local wildflowers breathed into place. The poles of the canopy bed pierced the clouds like ribboned castle towers. In another poem, I look like a man in a nightshirt about to sign something. In this one, a woman in a burqa is smoking in the airport restroom in Istanbul. She's the new Botticelli, Birth of Venus, the debutante spring. 100 kinds of wildflowers painted on green skies, pinflowers, forget-me-nots on Florentine moss. Meanwhile, down below, clouds move inside pornographic haunches of draft horses grazing in a padlock, and the local executioner is in his backyard pinning up laundry, souvenir t-shirts, an A-line dress, adjusting a cast iron cauldron, boiling things off. I look like I'm about to sign off or up at the back of a shop in a walk-in cooler. A meadow, a lapse in the woods, the oxen stirring, the bride in Vera Wang tosses bouquet into banners from the country fair. I move words in gold foil across a green desk, incognito, duplicates, pseudonym, ambiguities, tubers, a chicken mask, as banners exit the mouths of war horses.
So, Alex, thank you. And why did you pick that one to share with us?
I picked that one, I think, because, well, it's political, and it's takes a more global perspective, and also it changes in time. It goes back to, I see it as revolutionary figures in the American Revolutionary, and it goes up to Istanbul and contemporary times, and just around the idea of, some nasty things also happening. So these war horses and other things going on, execution in the poem. So.
There's a little bit of rebellion going on there too, right, Alex? A woman in a burqa, yep, smoking in the ladies' room. So,
yep, which I've really experienced. So
I figured. Joshua, how about you? What's the poem you're going to read from your own work for us?
Sure. I actually think I'm going to unexpectedly riff on Alex a bit. This is a poem entitled Ode to Long John's. And it's Ode, O-W-E-D, and it's from my most recent collection of books by the same title, Ode. I remember thinking, these are like skin for my skin, and a truer thing to call black to boot, as my first pair were blacker even than my nascent curls, which turned brown whenever they would wrestle the light. My father called you thermals, which always brought to mind radioactive weapons of one kind or another, two nuclear physicists using casual shorthand over coffee. For 10 years, under thrift store denim and corduroys rubbed raw by Miss Blint's blue carpet, I rock your soft scales with minimal fuss, only twice or so grumbling to Pop about how you make me appear, if not heavier per se than just, well, stuck in all of my clothes, that this is on the whole untenable for a boy my age. No small tragedy given these were formative years, you see, critical even as it pertained to the glowing affirmative sense of my body I would need for success in the general public situation. Pop's concern remained with the cold, and I remained a boy cocooned, fed up, hungry for better methods of breaking winter's callous rule. Anything other than having to leave the oven door open, setting my mother's best 4 black pots to boil at once. Our entire family gathered as if shrapnel in the living room, so close our bodies grew almost indeterminate there, huddled like stars under blankets to thaw.
It's beautiful.
Wow, Joshua, there's, you know, serious stuff in there, but also I heard, correct me if I'm wrong, a little bit of humor. You know, Dad just wants you to be warm and you're having a major protest.
Yeah, I mean, it's I want it to look cool and have the cool outfits. And he made me go to school with my long johns on. And I just became a father 3 months ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. My boy's name is August Galileo. So I wanted to read a poem with stars in it for sure. But I understand that a lot better now. You know, his main dream was always that his kids would be okay. So I have a bit more understanding for Dad now.
Yeah. And I was actually smiling while you're reading, because I still remember one phase when, I don't know, my sisters and I were maybe 8 or 6 or 10. And my father wanted us to get rubber boots because it's mud season in New England, you know. And darn it, we just did not want to wear those rubber boots. We just, maybe we were probably more like early teenagers, 12 or 13. And it was a fight. So I can relate to that Long John poem that you read. Allison, how about you? Your turn.
So I'm struck by the music of both of the poems we just heard. Really sort of, this is such a lovely way to start the day. The poem I'm going to read is called If Imagination and Memory Met Unexpectedly One Last Time. And what I was thinking about is how when, as many of us have had, if not all of us, when you have an intense love relationship with someone and then you break up or split up or divorce or whatever, and then you just don't see that person anymore. You don't really talk about that person or interact with that person in any way. I got to questioning like where that energy goes, you know, and in a way the person starts to exist in your imagination, in a way in memory. And so that was the premise of this poem. And there's one reference at the end to something called a rack line, which anybody who lives near a shore will know is that kind of oceany detritus line along the coast that where all the seaweed collects.
Oh, okay. I'm familiar with what it looks like. I did not know the name of it. So thank
you. The rack line.
Yeah.
So this is if imagination and memory met unexpectedly one last time. It would be this moment, the dark, slow mess of one body unpiling toward another in sleep, the longing of two waves reeling in queasy parallel. Mostly, it's like you never rested here, this body, your head never heavy as sorrow, as troubled bone, never turned in my palms like an artifact, gently undisguised. I shouldn't remember you as the trim boat you never were, this place as a storm. There are errands now, children. On the second floor of the world, a tepid bath fills. Some people will bear any anchor through the endless flaying tide. Our ocean unraveled quickly into salt, but listen for a second as we used to. Do you hear it holding us there? Scraping against the old undertow, minerals under motion, rock inside swell. No, shell, just shell, dry littering the rack line.
And what's important to you about that poem, Allison?
I think for me, just in terms of the processing of that poem, I sent that poem out for a while. When I wrote it, it felt like it captured something I felt deeply. And I sent it out for a bunch and I couldn't seem to get it published. And then once it was published, maybe 2 years after sending it out, I got letters from people who said, I felt this. This is exactly how I feel. And I feel, you know, there was like this connection. So it's really meaningful to me just to think about how we write our poems in obscurity, thinking, will anyone care? Will anyone ever read this? And then to feel like there's someone out there who needs this poem today. And so trusting instincts and feelings and niche experiences, that really matters to me.
That's great. And it's kind of the connection that, you know, I've never met Joshua, but that line about he doesn't want to wear the long johns, I so connected with that. There's a line that I love from a Jane Kenyon poem about the tyranny of the garden. And I often think of that when it's, you know, late summer and I'm drowning in, you know, tomatoes and lettuce and I basil, and I don't want to wash it and I don't want to store it and I don't want to put it away. So that's a line that's spoken to me from Jane Kenyon, the tyranny of the garden. We have a couple listeners actually who love Mary Oliver. Carolyn in Ware says a favorite of Mary Oliver for her is "I Happened to Be Standing." In particular, these lines, Carolyn says, "Then a wren in the privet began to sing. He was positively drenched in enthusiasm. But I thought of the wren's singing. What could this be if it isn't a prayer?" Phil also likes Mary Oliver. He quotes these lines, "As long as you're dancing, you can break the rules. Sometimes breaking the rules is just extending the rules. Sometimes there are no rules." Thanks to both of them for writing. And wow, all of you, thank you. Joshua, it was great to have you on the air. Thank you for being with us.
Of course, it's an honor and pleasure.
That's Joshua Bennett, Assistant Professor of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth College. His books include Being Property Once Myself, Blackness and the End of Man. Alexandria, it was great to have you back on the air with us today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, and I hope everybody has a healthy, peaceful week.
That's Alex Peary, New Hampshire Poet Laureate, the author of 7 books, most recently COVID Spring, Granite State Pandemic Poems. She's an English professor at Salem State University. And Allison, it was really great to have you. We'll have you back. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Allison Adair, associate professor at Boston College. She teaches creative writing with a focus on poetry, flash fiction, and the digital humanities. Her first award-winning book of poems is called The Clearing. And today's show was produced by Exchange senior producer Ellen Grimm. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.